Okay, so to continue, I'm not entirely done with the hindrance factors yet. I don't know if you had any opportunity to contemplate any of these particular winds being present in your mind in the last half hour. But I think there's a couple of dimension of these winds to understand. One is you can really see them as states of mind, as mental states. Very much the hindrance factors occupy a place both in the third foundation of mindfulness and the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So they're very much presented as being part of our emotional repertoire, as being part of the states of mind that we do experience that change. But perhaps you can also get a sense that through repetition, these states of mind also become tendencies. They become habit patterns. And if our particular mind heart is inclined to sort of favor one of these states over another, and we repeat it often enough, and it becomes a tendency, then we also tend to think of ourselves as being that state of mind. I'm this type of person, you know, I'm an aversive type, or I'm a greed type. Now, personally, I think that's quite offensive to yourself, because I don't think anyone is a type of person. But what you can see happening is through repetition, a mental state becoming a tendency, and because of its reappearance, that self-view becomes identified with that tendency. So then we refer to ourselves as a kind of type. I think, you know, the first step in understanding the hindrance factors, of course, is to undo that first layer of identification. You know, and clearly in the Satipatthana Sutta, you see that instruction over and over again to see a mental state as a mental state, not as I am. But then, secondly, to be able to track a mental state in all of its manifestations and all of its changes, to understand that this is the ground in which we cultivate the ennobling or awakening factors. Not when this state of mind is over. Not when it's over. That's not when we cultivate the awakening factors. We cultivate the awakening factors when this state is present and happening. So I think it is, you know, and this kind of reframes sometimes our understanding of practice, and I will get into this more as I talk about mindfulness. But how meditative practice in itself is a practice of engagement with. Engaging with what is happening, in a dialogue with what is happening. What awakens that which is not awakened? So the other piece I want to say about the hindrance factors is in Buddhist teaching, these five hindrance factors or veiling factors, because that's what they do, they veil our capacity to see things the way they actually are and to be with things the way they actually are. So in Buddhist teaching, these five veiling factors are said to be the five manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion. So those three kind of greed, hatred, and delusion is what makes the wheel of suffering spin round and round and round and round. That's what keeps it all going. Struggle and suffering is greed, hatred, and delusion. So these five hindrances are just the ways that we see greed, hatred, and delusion manifesting in our lives and as mental states over and over. So as I mentioned already, one tendency is to tend to minimize the hindrances and think of them as being preliminary meditation experiences. Certainly nowhere in the teaching is greed, hatred, and delusion mentioned as a preliminary meditation obstacle. But when we do tend to minimize the hindrances, we're not looking at how much these five factors are at the root of every single psychological and emotional storm that we experience in our lives. So it's very important to acknowledge that. You know, if you look at any time when, you know, you're lost in chaos or rage or confusion, if you look carefully, you will see these five veiling factors operating. So one extreme is to tend to minimize them, and the other extreme in that spectrum is to think of them as life sentences, as terminal conditions, you know, until I die there's going to be greed, or there's going to be dullness, or there's going to be, you know, delusion, or there's going to be anxiety. Well, a little bit makes a mockery of the teaching, quite frankly. Because much of this practice, I mean, and the Buddha said, you know, it's only an arahant, a fully enlightened being, who's fully free of the hindrance factors. So take some encouragement from that. But much of our practice is actually to do with seeing through what veils our capacity to see things as they are and to liberate the heart. So you should realistically anticipate in your life and in your practice to see the end of the hindrance factors. And without that, you know, we're kind of putting liberation on one side of the plate as kind of, you know, relevant to somebody else but not to us. So we're actually talking about how to liberate the hindrance factors, you know, because they actually, not only they veil our capacity to see things as they are, but what you also see is the hindrance factors actually veil and divorce us from pretty much what all of us most deeply value. You know, when the hindrance factors are in play, it's really hard to feel that sense of deep connectedness with confidence, with happiness, with kindness, with empathy, with freedom. So they have that factor of, you know, entangling us in struggle and suffering and creating a state of amnesia. This is what I think the hindrance factors do, is they create a state of amnesia. You know, you can see when you're, you know, when you're lost, for example, in restlessness and worry, you know, there's pretty much amnesia about impermanence, isn't there? You know, that when we're lost in kind of aversion, you know, or ill will, there's pretty much amnesia about our capacity for kindness and the value of kindness. You know, when we're lost in sloth and torpor, you know, we tend always to engage in postponement practice, you know, like the tomorrow, you know, is surely a better day to be awake. So it's very important to understand that part of the veiling factors is this amnesia-inducing mental state, which I think pretty much the hindrance factors are all a kind of amnesia. There's sort of forgetfulness, a forgetfulness about what we value. So it is actually so important to apply the awakening factors to them. This is where the dialogue is happening, you know. First to know, and we'll get into this in the factors of awakening, first to know what is going on, and then to understand what is going on, and to respond to what is going on. Nyanaponika Thera, you know, one of the elders of this kind of tradition, he once described the path as, you know, to know your mind, to shape your mind, to liberate your mind. To know your mind, or to know your heart, to shape the heart, to liberate the heart. And that's speaking of this dialogue with the awakening factors, which with the numbing or the amnesic factors. So we are speaking in developing the seven qualities of awakening, of bringing an end to greed, hatred, and delusion. We speak about envisioning a heart and a life no longer distorted by the experiences of suffering. Yeah.
I have a problem with hatred.
I do too. No, I'm not being facetious, yeah. Hatred, okay.
Okay. I do loving kindness meditations towards people that I love, that need it, that need it desperately, and the whole world, and everybody here, but I cannot do that towards a man who has abused my grandchild. And I don't want to. I won't go near it. I can't stand him. So, what do you think I should do?
I think you should reframe your understanding of metta practice. I think sometimes there can be the misunderstanding of practice, of metta practice, in the sense that somehow it is going to make us a person who has engaged in acts of inflicting suffering will remain, before metta practice, a person who has engaged in inflicting acts of suffering. And after metta practice, they will remain a person who has engaged in inflicting acts of suffering. Your metta practice is not intended to make this person to be seen other than the actuality. It is very important that that's not in your mind, because that it kind of twists metta practice. I think what we need, what is really important to understand, what's really pointed towards in the teaching, is that hatred poisons our own hearts. Hatred poisons our own hearts. Sometimes I think when there is hatred or ill will, aversion, if we look at how we are, how our minds and hearts are, when they're really in the midst of that, there's so much unhappiness. There's so much distress. It becomes so much of a trigger for recycling, repeating endlessly, the thoughts of ill will, the thoughts of hurt, the thoughts of pain. And it can just, I think what it's really pointed towards, to see it, how it keeps us stuck in a sense of deep, deep distress. So sometimes, metta practice, in terms of how it develops, often from places that are easier, as you say, towards people you love, towards people you feel kindly for, it's so that you actually get a taste of what your heart and mind is like in that place of kindness. The sense of ease, the sense of aliveness, the sense of connectedness. When it expands to include the difficult people, very difficult people, I think it's very important in metta practice to see the two dimensions of the difficult. There is the objective difficult, which will still stay, possibly, completely exactly the same difficulty. The person who really has been an abuser or whatever. There is the inner dimension of the difficult, which is, ill will, hatred, and in this tradition considered to be a manifestation also of fear. How that poisons our own life. So the metta practice is not so much about, thinking I should see this person differently. It's how do I hold the unhappiness of that hatred in my own heart? Can I turn a sense of kindness, of befriending, of curiosity, of inclusiveness towards that deep painfulness? Quite frankly, the person is very, very secondary. What's very primary is where we are making our home. What's very primary is where we are making our home. Because it's not as if, it is not as if we have so many choices about the patterns of mind that we feed. If I truly am in some way feeding consciously or consciously aversion or ill will, I might think it's just this person. But you know what? If we feed that pattern of mind, it will be triggered in countless situations. It's not as if aversion has this sort of territorial boundary and says, I'm reserving it for here, but never here, and never here, and never about this small thing, that it irritates me. So it's really much more a question of where we're making our home. And what we see in ourselves is conducive to the freedom, liberation of our own hearts and minds. It's not concerned with changing, particularly the fact or the actuality that this person is truly a difficult person. But it's really looking about what that emotional state does to ourselves, our lives. Sadly, yes. So I think it's very, very important to reorient metta practice, because so often it's kind of equated with having a certain amount of emotion, a certain kind of emotion, or a certain kind of feeling. You know, it's not. Metta practice is really concerned with where we're establishing our intentionality. Anybody else have, before we move on from the hindrance factors, anybody else have any queries?
Christina? Yeah. It seems like as I start to bring my awareness to the hindrances and just walking around and start to quiet those, that sense of insufficiency becomes more predominant that you spoke of last night.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to say that, you know, when we talk about the hindrance factors being veiling factors, what are they veiling? Not only our capacity to see things the way they are, but also sometimes veiling things we don't actually really like to see within ourselves. You know, and particularly thought and torpor, you know, you can see that, you know, there's a kind of what I call a sort of honest tiredness in life, you know. Like if I've run a marathon, you know, I've really kind of been working very hard. It's a sort of honest tiredness, isn't it? But when we really look at sloth and torpor, it's actually doing something entirely different, isn't it? It's actually sort of divorcing us from the way things are. But it's often covering up what we would rather not feel or be connected with. It's a kind of numbing quality, you know. So as you kind of, you know, really sort of practice with the hindrance factors, I think it does make us more aware of some, you know, it's like the five hindrances, manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion. Well, no, I don't think any of us particularly that enthusiastic about being connected with greed, hatred, and delusion. We'd rather not. We'd rather not. But, you know, there may be also whole other tendencies in there of insufficiency or lack, you know, that the hindrance factors are just keeping us either busy or asleep. You know, that's kind of what they tend to do. We either get very busy or we're asleep. So you can sort of see that in terms of liberating the heart, you know, the importance of not just sort of taking the hindrance factors too lightly and thinking about, you know, little stage, you know, actually what's going on underneath them. Yeah.
But in that situation, in terms of example, isn't that sense of insufficiency also doubt itself?
Yeah. So the question was whether what Tim was mentioning about looking underneath the hindrances, seeing the sense of insufficiency, is that also doubt? It's very much part of doubt. But it's kind of like the more subtle subtext of doubt. The busier text of doubt is, you know, oh, I don't think I'm doing the right thing and I should do this rather than that. And the more subtle subtext is that, you know, there's nothing I can do. And it's where, like, doubt, you know, in terms of the hindrance factors, doubt often marries itself to restlessness and worry. And craving, you know, because if I doubt, I'll get busy, you know, and I'll try something else, you know, I'll try this, you know, and this might be a solution, you know, so you can really see how doubt, you know, the hindrance factors are very rarely operating in a solo performance, you know, usually it's a compound, the way these mental states are interfacing with each other and strengthening and feeding each other, just as the awakening factors are also in a dialogue with each other, strengthening and feeding each other.
Yeah. One thing that was up for me when you were speaking is how hard sometimes it is for those of us who are practitioners, consider ourselves Buddhist practitioners, to have self-compassion for where we find our difficulties. And that I just felt like I wanted to say that, you know, we're so focused on the outer world that finding that place of self-compassion seems to be a priority. practice so worthy of reinforcing for the sake of all?
Yes, absolutely. And also, I think, you know, because maybe in the West we're used to more instant, you know, we have tend to have short-term view and more, you know, inspired by, short-term results. That, you know, I think when we really look at our own minds and hearts, when we really look at the teaching, the Buddha never underestimated the size of the cloth, you know, and how intractable many of our patterns are. But he said, you know, what is really primary, and you see this borne out in the Satipatthana Sutta, the outright through the teaching, is this path is really made hugely much harder when we take it all much so personally. You know, and how much we can turn practice into a new kind of criteria of success and failure when we do take it also personally, you know. And it's why so much in the meditative practices is there's a sense of seeing the universality of this cloth. You know that it, you know, when we talk about the mind and we talk about the hindrances, we talk about the awakening factors. Of course, there is the very personal and the very specific dimension of that. But we are really speaking about the universality of this, you know? And so it is really much more helpful to really notice when we tend to lean much more towards using the practice to reinforce I am, rather than to soften I am. And just to see, you know, the sorrow, for example, of hatred, you know? The sorrow of greed. It's not rather than I am like this and I should feel this and I should feel like that if I was a better meditator. It doesn't mean dismissing the personal, but it means recognizing the universality here. Okay, are we ready to move along here? So as I mentioned, just as the hindrance factors are in dialogue with each other, strengthening and reinforcing each other, so too are the awakening factors. Joy is engaging with concentration. Investigation is strengthened by energy, and everything really is happening on the ground of sati or mindfulness. It's a foundational factor. Sati or mindfulness is what allows the development of all of the other qualities. As I mentioned, as Nyanaponika said, it begins by knowing our hearts, by knowing our minds, by knowing the landscape of our lives. Mindfulness is about knowing what is happening, not only in the world, but in our own hearts. And, you know, we would question what can change inwardly or outwardly without that knowing. But it's also an informed knowing, because it's informed of knowing what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. Now, that knowing is not just part of our personal journey. It's been part of the journey of every social and political transformation. Every transformation of injustice in the world has always begun with that knowing of what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. So let's talk a little bit about sati, or mindfulness. Now, first to acknowledge, sati is the most frequently used word in the Buddhist suttas. But increasingly, of course, in our culture, it's very much become part of our culture, actually almost to the point of cliché, hasn't it? You know, I mean, if you go into any bookstore, you know, you'll find a whole spectrum of books, you know, about, you know, mindful parenting, mindful sex, mindful driving, you know, mindful stock car racing, you know, mindful, you know, it's just like, it's almost like just like this is the command, you know, be mindful, you know. So I want to unpack a little bit this word sati and to look at how it is used in the discourses. Because, of course, on one level, sati, or mindfulness, is remarkably simple. On another level, sati is so profound that it holds the whole tapestry of the teaching of liberation. And the Buddha is quoted as saying, I know of no other single thing to cause the arising of the wholesome, if not yet arisen, or to cause the waning of the unwholesome, if arisen, as sati, or mindfulness. I know of no other single thing to cause the arising of the wholesome, if not yet arisen, or to cause the waning of the unwholesome, if arisen, as sati, or mindfulness. He also said, the person who delights in sati, or mindfulness, and regards heedlessness with dread, is close to nibbana. And I think that's kind of like a very, it's actually quite a journey even to come to regard heedlessness with a little bit of dread, isn't it? You know, wholesome dread. You know, I really dread being heedless. Sometimes we like to be heedless, you know. I mean, you can see that in the mind, can't you? I just like a break from being mindful, you know. But like, then what happens is, usually what happens if you really look at those moments, what we're talking about, we'd like a sort of uncensored moment of entertaining the hindrances. Isn't it true? It's like we'd like an uncensored moment to entertain the hindrances in. But it also leaves a huge residue in the mind every time we do that, we see that. It's kind of like waking up from a dream. But I think it's also seen that the absence of sati makes us very vulnerable to the hindrance factors. That when we are not mindful, intentionally mindful, generally the mind, the heart, is very, very vulnerable to the power of the hindrance factors. They will tend to become the dominating force. You know, if mindfulness is not kind of the lead role here, the hindrances will be. And I just think it's just important to just sort of see that and see if that's true for us. Now, the one thing I would really like to make a distinction between, first of all, is the word attention, or the phrase bare attention, and sati, or mindfulness. Now, just to acknowledge that bare attention was a phrase that was coined by Nyanaponika around in the 1930s, and about 10 days after he coined it, he said he regretted it. And yet, this is what is often used to describe mindfulness, is bare attention. Now, bare attention is certainly part of the landscape of mindfulness, but it is not the whole of mindfulness. Attention is necessary for anything in our life. There is the word in Pali for attention is manaskara. Okay. Now, manaskara can be wholesome, in which case it's yanaso manaskara, or attention can be flavored by the unwholesome, in which case it's ayanaso manaskara. Now, noticing that attention is necessary for pretty much everything in our life. You know, if you're going to drive on the road without getting into an accident, if you're going to get out of the way of a bus, if you're going to learn to play the piano, if you're going to know what your child is doing, you know, as you're making dinner, if you're going to be educated, everything in our life needs attention. It's a faculty of our mind that we can develop, but actually it's actually attention's really not bare, is it? Because attention is, of course, flavored by a whole array of attitudes and values and beliefs and habit patterns and tendencies. You know, an athlete to climb a rock wall needs attention. You know, to sit in meditation, to even to sit here and listen, you need attention. you know, but a shoplifter needs attention, a burglar needs attention, you know, a carjacker, a sniper also has to have very finely honed attention skills if they're going to have successful outcomes. So I'm not convinced there is such a thing as bare attention. Attention is, of course, arising in a context like everything else in our mind. It can be wise or unwise. Attention is dependent upon the intentions, ethics, and attitudes that lie behind it. Those intentions, ethics, and attitudes are also going to shape the outcome of our attention. But more than that, they're going to shape what we pay attention to. They're going to shape actually what we pay attention to. So but attention is also necessary. It's a necessary part of mindfulness because it what allows us to sustain something, to sustain a focus, is developing attention allows us to sustain a focus. You know, rather than having a mind that is just flitting from one thought to another, you know, lost in entanglement, lost in this and that, attention is a skill, a quality that allows us to sustain a focus. But the word sati or mindfulness in Buddhist psychology and teaching is actually always a wholesome factor. That there, in Buddhist psychology, there is no such thing as unwholesome mindfulness. It is always a wholesome factor because mindfulness never comes to the party alone. Huh? Mindfulness is always coming to the party with a group of friends. Think of it that way. You know, that mindfulness is always informed by other wholesome factors, by ethics, by kindness, by investigation, by effort. It is why you never see just the word sati in the suttas. You always see the phrase samasati, or wise mindfulness. You always see wise mindfulness. Because wise mindfulness is always, it has a direction, it is always in the service of illuminating and liberating the moment and our hearts. It always has a direction towards liberation. There's a lot of different translations and metaphors that are used for sati in the sutta. Sometimes sati is translated as remembering. Remembering to be present, remembering to sustain attentiveness, remembering what is important. In this sense, sati is an antidote to the amnesic fact quality of the hindrances. It's remembering where we're going, what we're doing. Sati holds that quality of breadth, but also of depth. Sati refers to being wide awake to the present moment, non-interfering, able to comprehend what is happening as it is. Sati is sometimes described as a boundless state, abiding, diligent, and clearly knowing. Now, I'd like to offer you some of the similes that the Buddha used to describe sati, which I hope might give you a little bit more of a sense of the depth of sati.
Christine,
yeah.
Before you get into that, I should know this, I feel, but I don't. What's mindfulness and view compared with awareness? Are they the same? Or?
I think you do see the translation of the word awareness occasionally in the suttas, but it's very, very occasional. Huh? So the word sati is the one that is primarily used, but I think the way that, at least the way that I conventionally think of awareness, it falls under this umbrella of sati. Hmm? Clearly knowing, wide awake to the present moment. Hmm? Hmm? So one of the similes that is used is of the cowherder, and remember how much the Buddha used sort of agricultural similes because that was the culture of his time. It was the language that people could really relate to. So he used the simile of the cowherder who initially has to watch closely over their herd so they don't stray into the fields where the crop is ripening or ripe. But that once the crop was harvested, the cowherder would be able to relax under the tree and watch over the herd from a distance. So it really talks about, first of all, this capacity to focus, this capacity for spaciousness as being part of the same landscape of sati. So the sati in this sense is not straying. It's not distracted by all the goodies in the field. It's not kind of, you know. But once the crop's harvested, once the path is brought to maturity, sati relaxes its focus. Right? It's more spacious, more inclusive. So it's actually talking often also in this simile about not wandering into the hindrances. Not wandering into the hindrances. Another simile that is used, it describes the practice of the cultivation of sati as climbing into an elevated tower and having from there the overall encompassing view of the terrain, not identified with the particulars. So it's that inclusiveness that even though attention may be going to a sound or a thought, the importance of not becoming identified with the particulars, not losing the whole view of the moment. You know, that the sight of the thought of the body sensation is part of the landscape of the whole rather than being identified with the particulars. Now, you can see this in a meditative sense, but I think you can see it in a life sense too, can't you? You know, you say you're on retreat here, you know, and you know, you go out for a cup of tea at lunchtime, you know, and the person in front of you takes the last rooibos tea bag that you were going for, you know. Now, the next time you see that person, do you see the whole of the person, or do you see the person who took the last rooibos tea bag? I mean, we can see how this operates in our lives over and over again, how we tend to seize upon the particulars and mistake it to be the whole truth. We do this also, I might mention, within ourselves. And this is where we become a type, you know. I see the arising or the re-arising of aversion, you know, aversive thinking or ill will thinking. We become identified with it. I am. We don't actually notice all of the moments in our day that are not governed by ill will. We don't notice all of the moments of the day where there is kindness and spaciousness because we become identified with the particular and we lose the entire view. Okay? So that's one aspect of sati, is to hold the panorama and not just the zoom lens. Sati, the cultivation of sati is sometimes compared in the discourses to the taming of a wild elephant who needs to be gradually weaned of its forest habits of rampaging and being pushed by impulse. A gradual weaning, a gradual, gentle weaning of the habits of impulse, you know? So sati has that element, you know, of not being this sort of enforcer, you know, pilot in the cockpit, you know, the more enlightened judge. Sati has this quality of, again, knowing what's important, but a gentle weaning. So sati is sometimes also likened to the probe of a surgeon. And the function of the probe of a surgeon is to provide information about the wound so it can be treated. Okay? So it's to know the landscape. It's to kind of probe the landscape. It's where, you know, this investigative part of sati. What's really going on here? You know? Looking beneath the surface. What's actually happening here? To know what's going on in all of its dimensions. So sati knows what is going on, and it's then preparing the ground for wise effort and wise response. So it's not just a sort of, you know, kind of detached, sort of kind of homogenized seeing, you know. It's knowing what is going on. So sati is preparing the ground that we can respond to what is going on with wisdom. Another simile that is being, and it's important to acknowledge how much the Buddha used this sort of like diagnostic model over and over again, you know, and how the Buddha sometimes likened the path to being a healer, a doctor, you know. It's kind of knowing the nature of the illness, knowing the cause, knowing the prognosis, and knowing the treatment pattern, basically. He used that sort of model. The other model he used was of a farmer who has first to plow and prepare the ground so it can be planted. That sati prepares the ground of the heart, of the mind, with calm, with attentiveness, with friendliness, so that insight can grow. Another of the similes is of a charioteer. Think of a driver. You know, who guides their chariot or who guides their car through a crowd without causing harm, but that it has a direction. It's going somewhere. Actually has a direction, which is nibbana. Now, another of the similes, which I think is really quite an important simile, is sati is likened to being the wise gatekeeper of a town, who recognizes the genuine citizens and friends and admits them and offers them entry and doesn't offer entry to those who do not have good intentions. So sati here, it's talking about having a discerning element. Discerning what is helpful and what is unhelpful. Discerning what is skillful and what is unskillful. So I think you can see in these similes that there is nothing passive about sati. That sati has this whole kind of knowing, comprehending factors. And I think that this piece about knowing what it's wise to let through the gate and what's not, again, you know, I think some I don't know. I think sometimes there can be this sort of mantra, you know, about unconditional welcome, which I think is very true, but I think we need to understand what we mean by that. You know, and welcoming something does not mean entertaining it. I mean, there's a very big difference, isn't it? If you are hosting a dinner party and you get an intruder at your door, you know, it's very kind to offer them a glass of water, but if you offer them a 5-course meal, you know what that uninvited guest is going to think? This is a good place to come. You know, I'm coming back here. So, you know, you think about it, you know, like with some of the kind of thoughts and patterns that arise in our hearts and minds, very helpful, you know. Offer them a glass of water, you know, but do we actually really need to go around this one more time? You know, and I think many of us see in ourselves that some of our patterns of confusion, like we've been around those circles 5 million times, there is not one more drop of insight to squeeze out, and it's time to withdraw consent. It's just time to withdraw consent, with, you know, not out of aversion or ill will or suppression or anything else, but sometimes just to withdraw consent that I do not need to go around this circle one more time. And that there is maybe something wiser to do with my attention in this moment about what I'm cultivating, what I'm bringing into being. And, you know, that's not a kind of encouragement towards suppression or towards pushing away or resistance or anything like that. It's rooted in clear comprehension, but it's knowing, you know, like what's coming through the gate. You know, and sometimes just to know that maybe it needs to be not kind of re-entertained. Okay, so anybody have any questions about these similes before I move on? Yes. Question again, you know, just revisiting of the territory of the distinction between awareness and mindfulness. I mean, awareness actually in the suttas would be much more used interchangeably with consciousness rather than with sati. Be much more, you would find it much more in the landscape of consciousness. You know? Consciousness unobstructed by tendencies and grasping. That's where you see it. But again, as I say, it's really not a big word in Buddhist texts. It's not really considered to be the goal or anything else, you know. It's, you know, because the goal, if we put use those words, is wise view and liberation. It's not awareness. But you would find it more in the realm of consciousness rather than in sati. Vision. Yeah.
Experience, is that
what
I'm
hearing?
Yeah. Just the opposite of an expansive, open, wholesome view. Yeah. I'm wondering if it can be forms of heedlessness not destructive. I'm wondering about, say, reading a high-quality novel. That's not mindfulness, but can that be something that's still...
It's not heedless either. I wouldn't put that under the umbrella of heedlessness. I mean, and I think it's also looking at this difference between sati or mindfulness and attention, which can be wise or unwise. I mean, clearly, you know, to read a novel and get to the end, you need to sustain a quality of attention. Now, you know, if you know, of course, you know, depending on what you're reading, and I mean, but you are training the mind in attentiveness, aren't you? I mean, when you sustain a focus of attention, you are actually training the mind in attentiveness. Now, again, that could be wholesome or unwholesome. You know, somebody could watch a porn movie, you know, with actually the same sustained focus, but the intentions and the ethics behind it might be quite different. But I think it's also very important for us, and I will get into this later, about how important it is for us to sustain and to develop our capacity for attentiveness, because it is really one of the building blocks of sati. It's also what sustains sati to some extent. But I mean, that could be heedless, or it might not be heedless, you know. It might be heedless if it's being used to sort of cover up something that we don't want to attend to, that we want to avoid, then it could be heedless, you know. So, I mean, heedlessness is very important, not to, you know, think that heedlessness means every moment that we're not sort of engaged with, you know, contemplating our mind is heedless. It's not so, you know. You know, you play with a child, you know, you can be wholeheartedly attentive, you know. So it's not heedless. I'm not contemplating what's going on in my mind at that moment. It's not heedless. You know, heedlessness, the way the Buddha used it, is much more the kind of forgetfulness, impulsive forgetfulness. That's how really it's heedlessness is used. Impulsive forgetfulness. You know, so I walk out of here, you know, and, you know, I catch sight of something, you know, and before I know it, I'm over there, you know, admiring the hubcaps on a car that's not mine, you know, and thinking about how I'm going to steal it, you know. That's impulsive heedlessness, an exaggerated version, you know. That's what's meant by heedlessness, this kind of being lost in impulse. Because impulse is often about being lost in tendencies and hindrances. That's what heedlessness means.
When you said escaping from mindfulness, that's what kind of started me on that, because I was thinking, well, sometimes I might like to read a book, and it's kind of an escape from mindfulness in a sense, because you're not really focusing on the present moment.
Yeah, the book is in the present moment. You know, I actually, there's no such thing as a present moment. If I could just unpack that mythology, you know. I mean, and that has become, one of the most dire cliches of our time, you know, the present moment. I mean, where do thoughts about the past arise? In the present moment, you know. Where do thoughts about the future arise? In the present moment. Where is the reading of the book happening? In the present moment, you know. There can be this sort of cliched sense of the present moment as being this frozen point of what, you know. I mean, if we actually look at our life, there is actually no such thing as a present moment. You know, if you look at the world, excuse me, I'm going on one of my rants. If you look at the world, if you look at your mind, if you look at your body, what do we see? A stream of events. Nothing is frozen. Nothing is frozen. What we tend to do with grasping, we interrupt that stream of events, don't we? We try to take, you know, we kind of so focus on a particular that we actually don't notice the stream of events anymore, you know, the arising, passing. Now, what do we think about the being in the present moment? Are we also trying to freeze that stream of events? Actually, being present or awake to the fullness of the present, in my understanding, is being fully awake to that stream of events and not endeavoring to freeze or interrupt it, either through impulse or through clinging. So in that sense, there's no frozen moment of time. In fact, everything is, of course, can only arise and be seen in the present moment of its arising. But it's, I mean, you probably know that Pali is a language of verbs and not of nouns, so you would actually, it's better to say present momenting, you know, and I'm present momenting with this reading. Am I wholehearted there? Am I, you know, sustaining not only the attention, say, on reading the book, but also that attention on reading the book is resting in this wider landscape, where I'm still mindful of sounds, of body sensations, of sights that arise, but within that I have a sustained focus.
Thank you.
Sometimes I think the way I hear present moment being used, it's almost like life has stopped. Mm-hmm. And it's like discernment has stopped or something, but I think that's the way, my understanding, the way present moment has got a little bit sort of taken up too much weight. Yeah,
I was just thinking of, I was trying to think of an example of what is heedless reading. And I was thinking when I was a teacher of kids, and it was an after school program before they came in, and I was reading The Stranger, and I was reading it, and then it's like, oh, here come the kids, it's next, and you put The Stranger down with all the booty call ads in it, and then it's like, well, I don't know, it just seemed like I wasn't being mindful of the present moment or the present moments as they go along, and I shouldn't really have left the paper out for them to look at or to make paper mache out of. I had to kind of go through the paper mache after that papers to figure out, well, what can they, you know, what can we use? Do you understand what I'm saying? You don't.
Where is it? What was the heed? I mean, you started by saying that you're thinking about heedlessness.
Yeah.
So heedlessness was not being aware of the context of, like, putting down the paper where it may not be useful for these children to see it.
But I think of it as sort of being not mindful.
Yes, that is what heedlessness. That's what heedlessness is. It's what, and you can see when there's heedlessness that all kinds of things creep in, like lack of good discernment, like hindrances. You know, we lose the context of what we're doing.
Can you say a little bit more about the use of the word wholesome and unwholesome?
Okay, I mean, I think it's important to look at that. The question was about, in the words wholesome or unwholesome, which, you know, there's no getting away from it. You're going to see this endlessly repeated in the texts and the teachings. And I think it's very important that we have a sort of way of integrating that in a way that makes sense for us. Because, you know, we are so much, or many people are so much used to thinking in a more judgmental way or aversive way and a dualistic way of good versus bad. Okay, and wholesome and unwholesome are not concerned with that at all. I mean, the wholesome, certainly in Buddhist teaching, the Buddhist path, is that which is cultivated that leads to the end of suffering. That leads to wise action, that leads to the fruition of everything that liberates our heart. That is what is wholesome. The unwholesome, again, is, you know, you need to take away that whole aversive or judgmental piece and say, well, what is unwholesome? And I think then we can reframe that. It's hard to find the right English word for it, you know. Akusala, you know, kusala is noble, ennobling. Akusala is... what's the opposite of ennobling?
Degrading.
That might be something like that. Akusala. So what we're really, you know, and again the English I think sometimes gets very tricky here because, you know, we have associations with words which are not there in the Pali. But akusala, that which leads to degradation, to harm, to disconnection, to suffering, to heedlessness, to pain, to a minimizing of possibility, is akusala. So it's not just in the extremes of, you know, harm or, you know, inflicting harm. Akusala is that which leads to the minimizing of possibility, the restricting of the liberated heart. So sometimes the words skillful and unskillful are also used, but these are still endeavors to make sense of this Pali word, you know, which in English how often do you use the word ennobling? I mean, it's not really, but it's a lovely word, something that is ennobling, you know, which, you know, I think also from kind of maybe our psychological perspectives, we might think that it's too grandiose or something, you know? But actually, it's in Buddhist teaching, that's not grandiose at all. You know, the four noble truths are actually, the proper translation is the four ennobling truths. So the kusala, you know? And what is akusala, you know? Now, we certainly know what is akusala, or disennobling, because it leaves so many residues in our minds and hearts. I wish I hadn't done this, I wish I hadn't said this, I wish I'd, you know, had done this, I wish I had said this, you know, I wish, you know, the stories that spin around and around, the unfinished symphonies, they are usually symptomatic of akusala. If you notice what is ennobling, what is ennobling? Doesn't have many stories with it, does it? It's kind of like that. So, yeah.
Is every action going to be either, you know, qualifiable as either wholesome or unwholesome?
In the Abhidhamma, certainly, you would have every single thought, every single attitude, every single image, every single emotion, every single mental state would either fall within the kusala or the akusala. Because it's not just about what is arising, it's about the effect of what is arising. It is about the consequence of what is arising, not only upon the world, but upon our own hearts and minds. And that's why I said, you know, the seven qualities is really talking about the footprint of ourselves in the world and the footprint upon our own hearts and minds.
So a lot of things then are actions that are not necessarily wholesome or unwholesome, except in the way in which it plays out for you or what it means for you.
Yes.
So you're surfing. Big wave, you're in Hawaii, you're surfing. Are you avoiding something, or are you at one with nature and...
It's not entirely to do with what's being done or said, although that's not entirely completely off the table. But most of this teaching of liberation is concerned with what is actually going on that is guiding what is happening. Huh? Yes.
Can discernment result in judging or correcting hindrances and
absolutely
by, you know, somewhat wanting just an awareness of it?
Well, it depends on what we mean by just an awareness of it, you know, because there's nowhere in the discourses where it says just be aware of it. It's nowhere in the discourses that says just be mindful of what's going on. But I will go on to that, if I may, later on. that mindfulness is part, discernment is part of mindfulness, and discernment is preparing the ground for response rather than just being mindful. But I, if I may, I will go on to that with quite some length. Well, I actually think this is a good time for us to just take a minute to